Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing white farmer genocide and Trump administration's granting of amnesty to persecuted, quote-unquote, white South Africans. I'm joined by Professor Christy van der Westhuizen. Professor Wes Houston is the head of the research program at the Center for the Advancement of Non-Racialism and Democracy at Nelson Mandela University, South Africa. Her research interests include identities, difference, ideologies, and discourses with a focus on colonial, apartheid, and post-apartheid South Africa. Christy, I'm delighted to have you join me today. And I look forward to our conversation.
Wonderful to be with you, Michael.
Brilliant. So let's start off. So we recently seen a number of white South African farmers that were granted some kind of refugee status by the Trump administration were alleged to be persecuted, facing systemic discrimination in South Africa. So I think the question is, do white South Africans face systemic discrimination in South Africa today? Or is the claim exaggerated or politically manipulated?
Well, thanks for that question. So basically what we have is a claim that's made by far-right groupings in South Africa that there is some kind of so-called white genocide happening on white-owned farms, and basically the claim that's being made is that white people owning and working these farms as farmers are particularly targeted on the basis of being white. And what the reality of the situation is, as was also confirmed in the interaction in the Oval Office between President Donald Trump of the United States and South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa, is that that South Africa faces incredibly high levels of crime. This crime is not happening in a racially targeted way, by and large. In fact, it is targeting, crime is affecting absolutely everybody. And because the majority of people in South Africa, the vast majority, are black people, in fact, crime affects black people, of course, more. And so it's a completely false assertion that farmers are being targeted on farms for being white. And the Human Sciences Research Council in South Africa did a study a few years ago to actually further investigate this claim, because this claim has been doing the rounds, I would say, more than a decade, if not even two decades, and actually found absolutely no basis for it. You have criminal attacks happening on farms. Some of them are quite gruesome. Some of them involve torture, et cetera, et cetera. But these attacks are criminal. They're not taking place because the people on the receiving end are white.
Oh, that's very interesting. So if we look at it from the irony, so let's first deal with the paradox, because people like us, I've just recently reviewed I don't know, the anthropologist in Colombia, Rosalind Morris's unstable grant. And it's quite interesting when you read the history of South Africa with the apartheid system and how that targeted policies towards a particular demographic, the majority blacks. And now to then see the reverser, kind of like race reverser, to say the whites have been, sometimes it kind of presents some irony to people that have been following the apartheid system. So how would you see this perception of reverse racism? Would you say, is it rooted in facts? Is it fear or is it politics?
This is certainly politics. And in fact, I think that the claim of reverse racism is something that we've been hearing from the white right in South Africa and also elsewhere on the globe. And I think it serves a very particular political function. And the idea with it is to actually do also a kind of a moral reversal. And I've actually written about this, where if you think about it, Afrikaners particularly are, were maligned across the globe for the system of apartheid. Apartheid was seen as, in a sense, the last intense system of institutionalized racism standing in the world, you know. So, I mean, in terms of like, as a system of direct colonialism, direct exploitation, direct abuse and marginalization of black people. So that's why apartheid was very much maligned, to the extent that even countries that were supportive of the apartheid regime, such as Britain and the United States, actually changed their position towards the end of the 1980s. And with the end of the Cold War, the system couldn't continue at all, because the only thing that actually kept the apartheid system or the apartheid South Africa going was, in fact, the claim of the National Party regime that they were opposing communism and that they were a bulwark against communism on the African continent. So the minute the Cold War ended, it was also the end of apartheid. Afrikaners, very much as the people most associated with establishing apartheid and maintaining apartheid, suffered international stigmatization because of that. So if you now say Afrikaners are actually victims of black people, what you're actually suggesting, you know, as Donald Trump is doing, you're actually suggesting you're trying to do a reversal, a moral reversal, where Afrikaners become victims and black South Africans become perpetrators. And then with that, you are actually also, by implication, suggesting that apartheid was perhaps not such a bad system, and apartheid should actually have not ended. And when you end white supremacy, like in South Africa, white supremacy was ended with the end of apartheid. When you end white supremacy, then things go into chaos. You know, you have a collapse of a state and things become chaotic. And that then feeds all manner of racist ideas of black people as not able to govern, of black people as violent, etc., etc. So I think it's got a real colonial purpose to do this kind of moral reversal where Afrikaners are being depicted as victims, when in fact they are certainly not victims. They're not targeted as white people. They are victims as much as black South Africans are victims of crime.
So there are different layers to this. If I focus on Trump for now, before I come back to and look at him. Let's look at the spectacle that happened in the Oval Office between Trump and President Ramaphosa, where he was ambushed with a graphic details of some kind of like Berg and Where the Wild, and which has turned out to be, a lot of us say, that's not South Africa. So can you look at that within the narrative or discourse of misinformation? Mm. Or should we look at that within the discourse of that blatant, brazen, like what you've been saying now, like racial or white supremacies, or far right group, which some have accused Trump of kind of like emboldening or representing or symbolizing? How would you say it?
Mm. Well, I think that white supremacism is definitely using both misinformation and disinformation to advance its cause in the 21st century world. And it's been and because of online technologies, of course, the social media and so forth, it's become much more difficult to actually monitor or to verify information. And that's been abused by, certainly by white supremacists in advancing their cause. And their cause is very much dependent on lies, falsehoods, you know, just stories that are being made up, basically. And all those stories that are being made up are very reminiscent of the kinds of stories that were made up by Black people, about Black people during colonialism. So all of those, if we read, in fact, Ashiwula Mbembe, he writes about, you know, the kinds of grotesque caricatures that you had of Black people as part of, you know, part and parcel of the advancement of colonialism. It serves a legitimizing function because you know, there's a depiction of Black people as so-called savage, et cetera, and so forth. Mm. And in that way, you then justify colonialism. That's how it was done in the past. And now we have a situation where you have claims being made about Afrikaners as victims. And again, it serves an ideological function. But I think in this case, the concern is not so much with Afrikaners. I think it's actually about Afrikaners symbolizing the last institutionalized system of white supremacism and actually communicating that if you bring that to an end, as I said earlier, then everything descends into chaos. And it actually feeds into the so-called replacement theory. So if we want to look at the kinds of, you know, kinds of disinformation, this is a conspiracy theory that immigrants in Europe and people of color elsewhere in the global north are wanting to displace white people in various countries. Mm. And there's a concerted effort, actually, and this is called the replacement theory to replace white people. So if you can make the case around Afrikaners, this is what happens when white people lose power. They they become victims of Black people. For me, it serves the function of actually legitimizing an idea like the replacement theory. So there's a bigger ideological function that's actually got to do with politics in the global north.
Mm. I see points in what you're saying, because we've experienced similar stuff here in the UK in this summer, where there was a case where there was an incident where someone had unfortunately murdered some little children in a theater, and it has kind of like stoked this racist stuff, and the far right has kind of like hijacked that situation. But now, speaking of conspiracy theories and all of that, let's go to what is on ground. So what is so this whole idea of white people have been losing lands in South Africa, and they're seizing lands from them and taking lands from them. Is that true? What is the Land Act policy or law in South Africa?
Well, so in South Africa, we have a land reform policy because we actually have the mass dispossession of Black people, you know, under colonialism and apartheid. Most of the dispossession was actually already done by the start of the 19th century, so during the previous century, 1600s, 1700s, 1800s. Black people in South Africa were dispossessed of their land. And then under apartheid, of course, that process was further entrenched, also through the so-called Bantustan system, where H.F. Verwoerd, the architect of grand apartheid, came up with this idea of like a patchwork of ethnic statelets, one could say, like mini states. So all of that was entrenched during apartheid. We have shifted to a constitutional democracy in 1994. As part of that, of course, we have to redress the inequalities and the injustices from the past. So we've got a constitution, and we've got various laws that have been passed on the basis of that constitution. But unfortunately, the African National Congress, which has been the dominant party governing since 1994, has not been very successful with actually implementing the policy of land reform, the policy of land restitution, and so forth. So we, at this point in time, the last stat I saw was around about 30% of land that's actually in Black people's hands now. 30% after 30 years is really a poor record. The part of the problem is that we've been using the willing buyer, willing seller principle in South Africa as part of the land reform process. And that's where you have to pay market-related prices. We've definitely had an abuse of that system. So that is certainly part of the problem. But I must say the ANC has really failed massively in letting land reform happen. So we've definitely not had any extrajudicial taking of land or claiming of land. White people have not lost land that have been seized from them. That has certainly not happened. I think few cases of expropriation that we might have had, all that is happening in terms of the law. As has been said by others, including Cyril Ramaphosa, our president, the way that land expropriation works in South Africa, we've got an Expropriation Act that has just been adopted. It means that expropriation of land has to happen according to the letter of the law. It has to happen through judicial process. So the rule of law completely is applied, and there's nothing at this stage to suggest that it won't be applied going into the future. Of course, we do have some more populist kind of political leaders that have been propagating the seizure of land, but that is not policy. And in fact, if somebody should seize the land, then the police will hold upon to remove people from that land because you can't seize land in South Africa. And we certainly don't have a regime that allows the seizure of land at this stage.
I'll come to the populace. I think I have an inkling of who you're referring to, but I'll come to that in a minute. Let's talk about the ANC and how the ANC looks to have been punished for that failure that you mentioned in the last election, and where it lost its majority within the house and how to share going to coalitions with that. Do you think that is that in itself? Because from what people have been saying with the White House, kind of like misinformation, they also look at, I think President Ramaphosa also went with some, I don't know if Afrikaners or from his cabinet that were from these other parties as well that were represented in the space. So how do you think that is going to fix? Or how do you think the coalition, I guess the question is, is the coalition having, what impact does it have? Does it have the impact of spurring ANC to do what it should have done in the last 30 years of having dominance?
Well, some people are saying that it certainly holds the ANC to a different standard. Because what happened is that, as you say, in our last election that happened last year, the ANC, after 30 years of dominance at the ballot box, fell to 40%. So it was almost like, I think it's 17% that it fell, which is dramatic. So it had to constitute a coalition government to be able to rule. And that coalition government at this stage includes the official opposition, which is the Democratic Alliance. And Democratic Alliance historically is a liberal party, but I would say they frequently express their position in a more like a center-right kind of way. The ANC itself is quite centrist, but there's some that the ANC and the Democratic Alliance are both also quite neoliberal. So they actually also meet each other in terms of neoliberal capitalist policy. So the Democratic Alliance has been successful as a governing party where it's governed. And that is in the big metropolitan city of Cape Town, as well as in the Western Cape province, and also in smaller towns. So they've got a good record of governance. And that's why people are optimistic that they could possibly inspire the ANC to improve its own standards. But the ANC, I think, and this is something that going back to previous leaders such as Thabo Mbeki, who was the second Democratic era president, he spoke about the fact that the party had become a magnet for opportunistic people who have come in. I mean, certainly the party has been seen by many people as a vehicle to gain access to state resources. So corruption in South Africa has skyrocketed, and And in fact, we had what was called state capture, but I think it still actually continues, but it's most associated with the previous president, Jacob Zuma. And there we had more than R1 trillion that was lost in a period of 9 years to grand scale corruption and almost the destruction of our state-owned enterprises and so forth. So the ANC has actually now become associated with really, governance, massive governance failures, because at the same time, we've also got a problem with sanitation. It's difficult. It's becoming more and more difficult to have clean and safe water in South Africa. Electricity, we've had rolling blackouts for more than a decade. It's only been addressed in the last 2 years that we've seen an improvement in our electricity provision again. So all of that, the electorate definitely punished the ANC. But unfortunately, and I must say this is quite disquieting, is that we're seeing the mass withdrawal of ANC voters from the electoral process. So when we actually look at the figures, we can see that millions of people have just simply stopped voting. And these people were previously ANC voters. So it's a crisis of the ANC, but it's also a crisis of our opposition parties, because it's clear that they are not convincing the voters in South Africa to rather vote for them. And you see this kind of withdrawal from voting, and you also see South Africa is a very protest-intensive country. And so you see people are rather channeling their political energies into direct appeals at local local government and community level to try and get their politicians to address the very real need. In South Africa, 50% of the population are living under the breadline. In fact, that figure is a bit higher now after COVID. We've been very, very negatively affected by the pandemic, on top of existing inequalities inherited from apartheid, but also exacerbated by poor governance and corruption.
Speaking of poor governance and corruption, you did mention Jacob Zuma. And one of the episodes we've had in the past is looking at his comeback into politics after the whole corruption saga under the MK party. And we looked at it, I guess we look at it in two ways. Maybe it's the maturity of African democracy where they allow people like that to come back. And we're looking at it in parallel to Trump coming back as well. So I wanted to touch on that on one hand, and also to touch on one other thing that last guest was talking on, how post-apartheid guaranteed more like political rather than economic freedom to the blacks, and where the beneficiaries were just few black elites, whereas the majority, from what you said, where you have the majority were excluded, or the blacks were excluded from economic freedom in the past. But you've talked about some kind of improvement in the last 2 years. Okay. You've talked about an improvement in the last 2 years. So what would you say has shifted in the last 2 years to bring about this kind of improvement from the Jacob Zuma, dark days of Jacob Zuma till now?
Well, that's just in terms of electricity. So thankfully, our electricity problem has been more successfully tackled since the beginning of last year. It's actually a year and a half. And of course, electricity is absolutely central to a functioning economy. You can't actually have a functioning economy without electricity. So certainly, I've actually analysed, and other people have also analysed Jacob Zuma as a prototype actually for Donald Trump, because there are many similar strategies, political strategies that are followed, including depicting yourself as a victim, including being a sexual predator, including being associated with corruption, including being sort of thumbing your nose at the rule of law and so forth. I mean, there are many, many similarities actually, but between Zuma and Trump. But I think Trump is following Zuma's playbook because Zuma was already doing this stuff back in the 2000s. Certainly the situation around political freedom versus economic freedom, we can see that the economic freedom that people were not just hoping for, but were entitled to, black people, specifically has not transpired. And in fact, we've had a de-racialization of the upper echelons of our economy. Therefore, we've got at the incorporation of Black people into the upper echelons of our economy, we've grown the, we have certainly grown the Black middle class by several millions, but we have not addressed this this problem. If you look at the South African society, as I said, the bottom half, actually just over 0.5% of our population being mired in poverty. And but the thing is that the constitution that we have and the policies that we have certainly allow for redress. Part of our problem has been that the ANC adopted neoliberal policies from the early 1990s onwards. So we've had a kind of a self-imposed structural adjustment program in South Africa. And that is particularly opting for growth, redistribution through growth rather than growth through redistribution. And so this dogged kind of pursuit of growth as opposed to redistribution has meant that we haven't had at all in any way adequate redistribution of wealth. But it has allowed for a certain section of our political elite to come and say that the problem is actually the constitution, that our constitution is so-called Western and liberal and all of that. And that's actually what's hampering economic freedom. But in fact, it's not. It's the fact that we haven't implemented our constitution, and we haven't implemented policies that are based on our constitution, and that is a failure of governance by the African National Congress.
Very, very interesting that you say that, because this is still what is underlining the book project that you're part of as well, where you're looking at the utility of liberal democracy or liberal practices, looking at the social adjustment programs and all of that. But speaking of economic freedom, let's talk about the economic freedom fight himself and the leader Julius Malema, because he featured heavily in the exchange between Trump and President Ramaphosa in the Oval House, Oval Office, and also looking at his what he symbolizes. So in the UK now, he's recently been banned from coming to the UK. So what is your assessment of Julius Malema and his party and his philosophy, what he stands for?
Well, I've actually written on the question of the economic freedom fighters. It seems to me that they're more, or Malema perhaps as a leader, is more of a left posturing kind of leader. Mm. Because if you actually dig into the policies and look at the election manifestos of the economic freedom fighters and so on, the program that's actually being pushed forward is what one could call a state corporatist program. So it's actually, it's not, it's certainly not a socialist system that's being suggested by the economic freedom fighters in their policy documents. What is being suggested is a form of state capitalism, one could say, but with a particular racial focus, namely that Black groupings attached to the leadership of the party will benefit from arrangements with the state. So we'll have access to state resources and so forth. So that's not socialism. So even though there's a lot of red whenever you look at an EFF event, it certainly is not. If you drill into the policies, you're not seeing a pursuit of socialist equality. You're rather seeing pursuit of a particular Black grouping being benefited with access to state resources. So Julius Malema, of course, has always been a favorite kind of poster boy of the white right. And in fact, over the years, there's been an interaction between him and white right groupings in South Africa. And in that way, he's bolstered his own profile. And in fact, the groupings that he's in interaction with, the white right groupings, also bolster their profile, because they can now say, well, we're taking on Julius Malema, and Malema can say, I'm being taken on by these white right groups and so forth. So it's a kind of a mutually conducive kind of relationship with the white right. We both can get political capital out of it. So out of the opposition to one another, they're actually generating political capital.
Yeah, speaking of white right groups, so let's go back a little bit to the refugee status and how the conservative media in America were at the forefront of, you know, this, the Fox News and all of that, at the forefront of this farmers. How about in South Africa? How much impact did the media do you have? Okay, let's roll back. What is the extent of far right or media in South Africa, and how much role did they play in this white persecuted farmers and the refugee status that was granted by the Trump administration?
Well, it's not so much the media, but we've got some civil society groupings that are historically, you can actually trace their lineage back to the early 20th century in the whites only mine workers union, and over the decades they've survived and they've actually formed the kernel of the far right in South Africa, and they've survived into the democratic era, and they've formed what's called the Solidarity Movement that has got a number of different entities attached to it, including what they call the civic rights organization. They've actually appropriated, in that sense, they're quite similar to the alt-right in the United States. In fact, I think they're copying the alt-right in the United States in the sense that they are using ideas and phrases that's associated with leftist politics to actually advance their own politics. So they would quote Martin Luther King and so forth and so on, you know. So that kind of reversal that we were talking about earlier as well. So they've actually been, over the past, I would say, 10 years, they've been regularly visiting the United States, meeting with white right figures there, and pushing this idea of that that Afrikaners particularly are being targeted. When you speak to Solidarity, they are careful to say that they've never said that farmers are beholden to a white genocide, white farmers. But you find certain people who've been associated with them in the past who have actually made that case more clearly. So that's they do have a media arm, Solidarity, I haven't actually specifically looked at how it's called Marula Media, how Marula Media depicted this. I think lots of the white right discourses in South Africa are in any case being advanced through social media channels and so forth. Your mainstream media in South Africa have completely rejected this discourse of white genocide, and they've actively actually done factual analyses to show that it's completely false. So, and they've also exposed some of the white right figures in South Africa that have been using social media, particularly X, Elon Musk's destruction of the Twitter platform, X. News24, for example, has exposed a particular person in a white male in South Africa who was using X as a platform to advance this idea of a white genocide, and he would then post stuff on X, and then Elon Musk, because he's got hundreds of millions of followers, would then repost from this guy, and so on. So you actually see social media particularly being used, and certainly the mainstream media have been actually quite good in terms of exposing the lies and misinformation and disinformation.
Before we come to the last question, let me talk about in line with this situation, the South Africa, maybe African general as well. We were talking before we started recording this. The Trump's suspension of USAID, and how that South Africa was kind of like badly hit because, you know, of the HIV programs, you know, that rely on this kind of aid, and also a direct threat to South Africa trade and all of that. How did South Africa respond to that? And do you think that is adequate, or how should they have responded, in your opinion?
Well, the response is a bit slow, and certainly because you know, there was in fact a little bit of an arrogant response from our ruling elite around that we're not so dependent as South Africa on USAID funding, which is true. If you compare us to many other African states, we're not that dependent. I think it was something like 17% of our budget comes from USAID. This is not particularly our HIV/AIDS budget. But then it was revealed actually that a lot of our research at university level, and we, South Africa is at the forefront actually of HIV/AIDS research on the globe, and we actually, in a sense, other countries across the globe are actually dependent on the kind of research that we're doing here. We're really leaders in this regard. And particularly at university level, many of these research units were dumped into a serious crisis with the withdrawal of US funding. So now some appeals have been directed to the government, because the government would need to step into the breach there and fill that gap. Whether the government will, I mean, I haven't actually seen any update in that regard. Hopefully a government will step in. But South Africa is under a massive, our government's under a massive budget crunch because of the years of state capture. We've lost incredible amounts of money. And with that, we've also had very, very low economic growth, to the point of every now and again going into economic recession. So budgets are being cut across government departments. So this is going to definitely affect us very negatively. We're basically dealing with a lot of crises. But I do think all this undue attention that we definitely don't want from Donald Trump is perhaps helping us to focus our minds a bit more on what's important for us as South Africans.
Yeah. And that brings me to the conclusion. I like the last statement you said, which is, I'm quite aware of South Africa's lead when it comes to research, when it comes to the universities and stuff like that. So I guess my question would then be one, how do South Africa, or how do Africa in general, the African Union or whatever organization that is representing Africa as a whole, deal with such misinformation, whether it be from Donald Trump, whether it be from Russia or other parties external to Africa? Or how can South Africa and other people also launder in a positive way this many positive stuff that it's doing? And also to create the impression that we do not rely heavily on this. These are all the good, laudable things that we're doing. What needs to be put in place? How do you prepare for such fascist or such white supremacy or such misinformation? How do you respond to it as a country, South Africa, then as a continent? I wanted to conclude on that.
Well, I think it's very difficult because, as we know, Donald Trump is running his presidency like a reality show. So it means that he's trying to strike a number of headlines every single day. And it's incredible actually to see how he's maintained a presence, you know, in the headlines across the world since he's taken office. And that's an avalanche of misinformation, disinformation. And the Oval Office was actually, the interaction with Cyril Ramaphosa, our president, was actually very informative to see actually how it works, because whatever Cyril Ramaphosa was saying, Donald Trump would just keep, you know, on his script. His script was, there's a white genocide, white farmers are being killed, their land's being taken, and he just kept on repeating it. And of course, for his followers who are in echo chambers, that's what they're hearing and that's what they're believing. So it is very, very difficult in this period now, also because of how algorithms can be manipulated and are being manipulated to work against us. So we do need, that's why we need mainstream media, we need committed journalists, we need investigative journalists, we need fact checkers, we need our universities. You know, that if you look at it, this fascistic onslaught against the universities in the United States is also part of this attack on information and access to information, which is a basic thing that you need for a functioning democracy. So I'm afraid we've got our work really cut out for us. But I am, you know, inspired by the fact that we see people, you know, activists, but also ordinary people on a daily basis also writing against this, you know, expressing themselves against this. And we need further mobilization We also, we need to protect our media organizations, and we need to support them because they are actually helping us to make sense of a situation where we've got a class of political opportunists, not just in South Africa or in the United States, but across the world, who are actually trying to advance a power project to concentrate unfettered power in their own hands. So that's what we're up against, actually. And that's why democracy is in the direct firing line.
Thank you very much, Christy. This has been a very interesting and exciting conversation. I really enjoyed your rich insight into this conversation, and I'm going to leave you to enjoy the sun in Prague, and I look forward to joining you in the next 2 days, and definitely we'll definitely meet up and talk about this project and how we can get all of this done. But I do agree with you on all of this stuff that you mentioned. Thank you very much, Christy.
It's very good to be with you, Michael, and thanks for the conversation. Let me know when it's online.
Yeah, I'll let you know, definitely. All right, thank you for now.
Keep well.
Yeah, you too. Thank you once again for joining me in this very exciting episode with Professor Christy van der Huizen, professor at Nelson Mandela University. And as usual, join me to thank her for her very rich and insightful commentary and analysis on the white farmer genocide, purported white farmer genocide, and Trump's administration granting of amnesty to quote unquote persecuted white South Africans. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.